All right. Hey there, everyone. This is Bram Kanstein, and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. With the guests on my podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technological discovery that you should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Dennis Porter. He's the co-founder and CEO of Satoshi Action Fund, a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to informing policymakers and regulators about Bitcoin mining, education, investment, and innovation in the United States. He's already gotten two bills into law, orange pilled a few states, and is on his way to many more. He's a true Bitcoin advocate and political strategist who's highly dedicated to protecting and defending Bitcoiners and the Bitcoin industry in the United States. So I'm super excited to talk with him today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Bram. It's excited to talk about all things Bitcoin.
Yeah, man, I see you traveling all around the place. So first off, I wanted to start by saying thanks. Although I do not live in the US, I think what you are doing is very important. And I hope you set a precedent with your work and inspire like others around the world to go out and educate their legislators too. Like I haven't seen anyone else outside of the States actually doing the same work. So maybe that's something you are also working on. I just want to say thanks. Like, I think it's very inspiring that you are doing your part in this way, and it's very cool to follow. So I wanted to start with that.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. We're having a lot of fun. And one of the things that people say, you know, they often tell me in that line of like sort of the United States, my focus on the United States, but we really see the USA as a potential leader on the technology, but we don't want it to just be about America. We certainly want the good ideas that take place here, the success that we have here in America, to permeate throughout the rest of the world and across the planet. And if there's any ever anyone listening in that wants help or advice on how to have an impact locally in your area, yeah, feel free to reach out.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I would implore anyone to do that. I think you have a lot of experience already. Before we talk about your work, I'd love to learn more about like how did you discover Bitcoin and what was your journey in understanding it?
Yeah, so first found Bitcoin in 2017 and immediately was drawn into its potential as a technology to be able to bank the unbanked and provide financial services to people across the planet. Since discovering Bitcoin, I've of course gone on to find a lot of other things that I love about it, including its ability as a piece of energy infrastructure to help balance our grid and to be able to mitigate methane emissions and to be able to enhance carbon-free energy projects, wind, solar, nuclear, you name it, and to be able to drive our energy systems forward. So tons that I've learned along the way, but ultimately when I found Bitcoin, I found it because one of my friends said that he had discovered perfectly anonymous internet money. And I said, that's bullshit. There's no way, excuse my language, but there's no way. And so I started to research it to find out, or to prove him wrong, really, you know, like nothing better than proving someone wrong. So I went on to study Bitcoin pretty aggressively just to prove him wrong. And in that moment of proving him wrong, because it's not perfectly anonymous internet money, there is significant privacy enhancements. While I was there, I discovered those things about financial inclusion and the ability to bank the unbanked and to be able to have a positive impact on society. So since then, I've gone on to learn much, much more about Bitcoin, as I stated, but also have launched a pair of nonprofits to be able to defend Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining here in the U.S., particularly at the state level. We're sort of bearish on Washington, D.C. We believe that the states are going to pick up the mantle, the states are going to be the ones to lead, and the states are going to be the ones to develop the ideas around how we want to regulate or not regulate this industry. And so we've had a lot of success at that. So far, our thesis has held up true. DC still hasn't done anything since we launched a little around 2.5 years ago. We think that trend will continue for some time. And if it does, then we'll be here ready, willing, and waiting to make a positive impact at the state level for lawmakers and folks in America who want to see this technology flourish in our country.
Yeah, we'll talk about it in a second, because what I loved, I heard you say you basically are using a loophole, right? When you talk about educating on the state level and creating laws on the state level, the fact that the federal government cannot force the states to follow government laws, right? If the laws in the states are different than the federal laws, right? I heard you mention like the cannabis example, right? If the federal government criminalizes cannabis, but it's legal in the state, then they will not send the feds to bust the cannabis dealers, basically, right?
Like, I mean, they could, and I don't know if I'd call it a loophole. I mean, it's just
I don't know. Sorry, no legal speak. Yeah,
it's in the Constitution. Was put there by our founding fathers, but I get the point, though. I just wanted to clarify for your audience, not a loophole. But certainly there are protections there in the Constitution for the states. And, you know, one of the main components of the Constitution is that if there is a law that contradicts between the states and the feds, that the feds could go in, they could go in and like do it themselves, but they can't force the states to enforce that federal law. So we're seeing that play out really effectively vis-a-vis the cannabis industry. You still see the feds operating. We still see them trying to do occasional raids and take people down. I'm not sure why they pick the people that they do. But the point is sort of that they are limited in their ability to have a broad cannabis takedown when they don't have the states on their side, because the states have the police and judicial infrastructure to manage all of that, that sort of a takedown of the cannabis industry. And we saw them do that for decades very effectively in coordination during the war on drugs, which of course cannabis was included in that war on drugs. And then now we've seen a shift. We've seen, as of 2012, really was when the big shift started to take place. We started to see states, get pitched this idea that cannabis is good for them. And it's not just good for, you know, a cannabis user who wants to smoke or to consume, THC, but also for the state, because the state can get a higher tax revenue. The state could get more jobs. There was an argument that this would reduce crime because you're sort of eliminating the need for the cartels to be involved in this process. And then because of all of these other effects, now you're starting to see property values increase, communities grow and flourish better. There's sort of some, you know, for folks that are concerned about social justice or about criminal justice reform, you know, a lot of positive impacts in that world as well. And that was the pitch to the states. And from 2010 to 2012, they started doing this pitch. And then in 2012, they convinced Washington State and Colorado to pass, you know, very pro-cannabis laws. And ever since then, we have seen 75% of the country pass pro-THC laws in one manner or another. And so you've seen this industry take off across the country, and yet it's still a federal crime to possess, distribute, or grow marijuana, to operate a marijuana business. It is still, in many cases, very difficult, although this is changing kind of right now as we speak, but it has been historically very difficult to gain access to banking for the cannabis industry. In many cases, they had no access to banking. And these are very similar problems to what we experience in the Bitcoin space. We see them sort of in a worst case scenario where things could go, where the feds have created something and made it illegal. But what we want to do is we want to make sure to get ahead of that. We want to make sure that there's just really no opportunity for something like that to set in. And so we're following the same example of the cannabis industry, except there's a few things that are slightly shifted. One is that we're starting in red states. Red states seem to be more open to this off the cuff. I ultimately am in Oregon. I'm in a blue state. So of course I want to see blue states join the battle to defend our, you know, fundamental Bitcoin rights as much as I want to see red states do it. But I'm also not going to wait for the blue states to be ready for the red states to start get going. So we started in the red states. We passed, same as the cannabis industry, in our first year, we passed two bills into law, one in Montana and one in Arkansas. That bill basically at its core is a fundamental Bitcoin rights protection bill. So some people call it the Digital Bill of Rights. Some people call it the Bitcoin Bill of Rights. But at the end of the day, what it does is it protects your right to self-custody, protects your right to run a node, protects your right to mine Bitcoin, protects your right to buy, sell, trade Bitcoin as well. And all of these things are all together what I would call essentially, you know, Bitcoin rights. Like, if you can't self-custody Bitcoin, you never really can own Bitcoin. It's just some sort of IOU. And then that's likewise on the mining side. I think mining is critical for the future of our energy systems. Not only is it critical for defending Bitcoin, but it is critical for, I think, really the future of energy here in the United States. know, we face a lot of energy problems. And one of the biggest ones that we face as we try to decarbonize and try to move to a more fully electrified economy, which I don't know where your audience stands on the politics of that. It's just, that is what's happening. Like, we even see utilities and public utility commissions in red states pushing for decarbonization. So this is just the direction we're headed in. And yeah, that direction requires that we have a massive amount of demand response and additional ancillary service programs on the grid and loads that can participate in those services as well. And Bitcoin mining is by far and away the best demand response customer on the planet, in my opinion. I'd love to hear a debate where one is better when you take in the whole picture, especially when you take in the economics, because this is a demand response customer that is very good at making money, literally prints Bitcoin. And there just really isn't a lot of other customers out there that are profitable, but yet can also engage in this level of sort of demand response and ancillary service program. So I want to make sure as much of that stays here in America as possible. I want to make sure that my rights are protected as much as possible. And we have found that the states are the best avenue to get this done. Just like the cannabis industry before us, we're going to go state by state and, first of all, create a bulwark of protection for Bitcoin users in America, but then use that bulwark once it's large enough to impact federal policy. And just like the cannabis, sorry to use this example, but it's just so easy to use because it's happening right now, just 10 years in advance, right? They are already seeing now, they're trying to pass laws at the federal level to give banking to the cannabis industry now. They're trying to remove it from the schedule at the federal level. But in my opinion, I don't think any of that happens without the pressure at the state level.
Hey there, thanks so much for listening to this episode. I just really want to ask you for a quick favor. Over the last few months, I've seen that only 75% of people who listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube are actually subscribed. The most important thing I'm currently focusing on, next to hopefully giving you interesting conversations, is growing this podcast subscriber base so I can continue with it into the future. I want to thank everyone who has been viewing and listening to Bitcoin for Millennials, leaving comments here and sending me DMs. It's been super, super motivating. So thank you so much. So I really want to ask you to please hit the subscribe button on YouTube or follow me on your favorite podcasting app if you are enjoying this podcast. Thanks again for joining me on this journey. Now back to the conversation.
Yeah. And so we'll talk a bit more about the tactics and the implications. I wanted to loop back a little bit to your journey.
Yeah.
Of course, nobody understands Bitcoin at the first try. Like, and you have also been deep into education right now, obviously talking to people who maybe just heard about Bitcoin, but then when you come in, you know, you give them the masterclass, perhaps, like the masterclass intro. Like, what for you was a belief that made you like not get Bitcoin at the beginning when you encountered it?
I wouldn't say that I had any holdups when I found Bitcoin. I might be one of those very few people who found Bitcoin and immediately became obsessed with Bitcoin. I got lucky though, because my friend had sort of challenged me to prove him wrong. And so I came in with this like very different intention. I had no intention at all of discovering something. No one told me it was a good thing. So maybe it was like the reverse psychology a little bit. Like, I was coming in already to prove that it was not capable of doing something that it actually wasn't capable of doing. And so then, but while I was there, I was reading, you know, and books by Andreas Antonopoulos. I was reading, listening to his speeches. There were a few other players as well in the space, some folks on Twitter and Reddit that I was reading up on, but mostly it was the Andreas Antonopoulos sort of viewpoint that this is an unstoppable money with incredibly positive outcomes that it can provide. Predominantly for me in the beginning, it was all about financial inclusion. It was all about being able to give accessibility and banking the unbanked. Again, of course, I've gone on to appreciate so much more. You know, for instance, like the ability for Bitcoin to be a money that is totally of almost like, what do you call that? Is impossible for it to be debased, right? Like, you can't debase this money. People call it an inflation hedge. I say it's a debasement hedge. Like, you can't.
Yes.
You cannot debase Bitcoin. It's impossible. Because people get stuck on like inflation hedge, and then it's all about the number, and it's all about, you know, whether or not inflation went up, and then how did your asset, you know, relate to that or correspond to that level of inflation. And then all of a sudden it's a debate about whether it really is an inflation hedge. But there is no argument that Bitcoin is a debasement hedge. You cannot debase Bitcoin at all, no matter what you do. And obviously it's very clear that at any given time, And quite often we are debasing our fiat currencies, the currencies like the United States dollar, the euro, yeah. The yuan, you name it, they're all getting debased.
Pretty interesting that it was like an ego test, but in a different way than in general, right? How people challenge, like struggle getting into Bitcoin. But that's a great story. So what do you think the main thing is that people need to unlearn before they can understand Bitcoin? Like, you were driven by proving your friend wrong. So maybe that was enough for you to also get past the things that you probably ran into that you thought, you know, were true before, or having a certain view of the world or money or economics. In general, you know, everyone runs into something around their personal beliefs or understanding, right? When they try to understand Bitcoin, like, what do you think is the main thing people need to unlearn?
Yeah, it's unlearn or realize they never learned it at all. And that's money and that's energy, right? Like, those two big things, like, whatever you think you know about money and whatever you think you know about energy, you probably don't. Like, you know, you get into this and you realize that all the money all the time is being debased, and you quickly learn what happens over time, eventually, with every single money that has ever been faced with debasement. And then you sort of can see into the history of, you know, where we're about to go, or excuse me, the future, which is about to become history, but we see into the future of where we're about to go. And you, you realize that we're not headed in the right direction, and that there's really not a whole lot you can do about it other than just to slow it down. And the same thing is true with energy. I don't think very many people at all, I've even found some in the energy world, and I don't mean it to disparagingly, but I just mean that there's just not enough education around how energy actually works. I don't consider myself to be an expert, by the way. I just have done enough of my own time in the space, doing my own research, talking to various energy experts and professionals, to put myself in a position where I at least understand enough to know that we need to make some drastic changes around the direction we're headed in with regards to energy. We need to be very cautious of how we move forward. There are two sides to this coin. You have people that are very concerned about not moving fast enough from an environmental perspective, or from a climate perspective, but we are already seeing what happens when we move too quickly and we make, you know, bad or poor policy decisions. As an example, in Germany and in parts of Europe, we have seen a lot of successful attempts to shut down nuclear power plants. And the argument is that it's bad for the environment. And yet at the same time, nuclear might be the most important, you know, climate energy technology that exists. I mean, there's just no other, I mean, if you want society to stay the way it is, right? Like, do you want to still wake up and be able to use your phone? Do you want to be able to afford to be able to take a hot shower? Do you want to be able to, like, be able to wash your laundry, like, you know, cook your food? These are very basic things. Like, if you want to go back to the Stone Ages, like, fine, like, let's get rid of these energy assets. But I'm pretty sure 99% of people do not want to go back to the Stone Ages. They just are concerned. But that concern has been misplaced around nuclear. Like, nuclear is probably the most important energy technology that we have available to us. And that also simultaneously brings everybody together. Because, of course, you're not going to get the environmentalists to be pro-coal, but you can get them to be pro-nuclear. And that's important because it is a baseload technology. And for those of you that are on the show that are learning more about energy for the first time, like, you need energy assets that can essentially be available beyond all the time. On-demand energy is what I call it. And wind and solar are not on-demand energy. They are intermittent energy assets, which only produce energy when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to be, you know, using my phone only when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining. Now, people will say batteries is the solution here. And I think that batteries, and certainly as a technology, have promise, but they're not the entire picture. In a world where we move away from traditional energy assets and traditional energy from fossil fuel, like, you need a truly very dynamic energy piece of, an energy grid. You need a very dynamic energy grid that can support all sorts of different ways to balance the grid and ways to interact with the energy assets that you have. And Bitcoin is very clearly one of the pieces of the puzzle. It may be a medium-sized piece. It may be a huge piece. That's sort of TBD into the future. But it is absolutely, most certainly, a piece of that future, because it is so, so, so good at providing energy back to the grid when other people need it, because it is one of the only, truly one of the only loads, large loads, which is the most important part. Not just, you know, if you flip your, as an example, if you flip your light switch on and off when they need you to, that's not enough energy to balance the grid. You need large loads of energy to turn on and off. So anyways, I'm going on a long rant here. You've got me going, Graham. I'm all excited to talk about Bitcoin and get deep into the weeds. But at the end of the day, you know, these technologies are going to have a massive impact on society. The more you learn about it, the more you realize that you don't understand money and energy and probably a few other things as well. So I encourage people certainly to dive deep and continue to learn. And also there's a huge benefit to it, because you can grow your wealth and grow your knowledge at the same time.
Well, this tangent does give me some thoughts around this side question. Maybe it's a big gets a big answer, but do you think like these degrowth people, right? Because it's the same in my country. Actually, now they're exploring where they are going to put up nuclear reactors again when they shut down shut the other ones down like 3, 4, 5 years ago, something. So it's very weird. Do you think like these degrowth people also? I don't think they realize that you throw us back to the Stone Ages in a sense, right? As you just mentioned. But I also think that they don't realize that, or maybe they expect we could survive this because we have a money, for example, that's functioning. I think it's all kind of like intertwined, right? Like if you are not aware of how base layer technologies work, like the money or like the constant energy, as you mentioned, then you're kind of talking on somewhere on a level layers above that, right? And then you can decide like, oh well, yeah, of course we should shut down the coal plants, we should shut down the nuclear plants. But it's not it doesn't come from understanding of what are basics that are needed for a functioning society, right? Like the discussion is at some upper level where people don't really understand that. So I think it's actually very fascinating that Bitcoin touches both of these really big subjects, right? The money and the energy. Mm-hmm. And that's also probably why it's also hard to understand, right? Because every time when you talk about this, or at least when I have some conversations, you know, people are like, yeah, really? Does it really touch everything? Does it really solve everything? You know, people don't like to fix the money, fix the world thing. But yeah, I don't know. Like once you see that, then it's hard like not to talk about that. But I do understand like why it's such a struggle for people, because you really like flip their understanding of how the world works or how a society works. You know, you flip it upside down, and that's just a hard thing to digest, I would say. So yeah, we'll get to how you experience talking to legislators. But now that you understood this after the challenge with your friend, like, how do you get to a point where you decide to dedicate your life to this?
That's a great question. So I discovered Bitcoin 2017, a little later in 2017. And I didn't have enough time in that cycle to really understand what was going on. I certainly saw it as a valuable piece of technology, and I wanted to get more involved. I tried to teach myself to code so that I could create a Bitcoin app of some sorts. And then I quickly realized why I hate school so much and why I dropped out of school. So I stopped that endeavor. And then I decided I wanted to mine Bitcoin. And so I started mining Bitcoin out of my garage. Ultimately, spent more money than I made on that operation. But I really enjoyed it and wanted to expand it, and was about to get ready to expand quite a bit. I saw myself, you know, if I could just get to, cheaper energy source, right, or a better way to, you know, in a better facility to mitigate the noise, and also to mitigate the heat that was coming off the machines. So, right when I was about to make that move, the market starts crashing, and I just sat to myself and decided that I needed to take a little more time to understand what was going on here and, you know, how the cycles work. I started to learn a lot more about that, and that this is very cyclical. And so I thought, okay, well, I've got time now. I'm just going to sit back. I'm going to stay quiet. I'm just going to keep learning. So from 2017 to roughly 2020, I continued to learn and just grow my knowledge and read as many books as I could. There wasn't as many out back then as there are now. I mean, there's like too many books now. So I was able to read the ones that were available. Andreas Antonopoulos, as I mentioned, was a very common one and a common person to listen to and read from. But 2020 comes, the shutdowns come, Sailor starts to come in, and I realize I'm like, it's coming. It's going to happen again. And like, we're going to go through another one of these cycles. And so I need to do whatever I can. I was like, I just got to get in the space. I just got to find a way to do something for Bitcoin. Because of course, right when you realize the value of Bitcoin, the potential of Bitcoin, you immediately think of how you can work in Bitcoin, right? So always was a plan from the very beginning, I guess. And so things start to take off. I was like, I'll launch a podcast or something. Like I'll just start speaking about Bitcoin. And Clubhouse comes out. Mm-hmm. Clubhouse is like the predecessor to Twitter Spaces. For those of you that don't remember Clubhouse, it was a very brief window when it was popular in 2020, 2021. And jumped on there, started to have a lot of success with that platform, started to have a following that would grow, and also started to have like a regular like show on there on Clubhouse. Eventually converted that to a podcast. And then I, with the podcast, went over to Twitter. I hadn't really used Twitter at all previous to this move, which was roughly, that must have been like 2021, I think, when I first started to tweet. But that that started really taking off. So grew the show was becoming very successful, was growing. And I thought that was going to be sort of my long-term thing. That's what I was going to do. Like maybe I was just a speaker for the space and, a Bitcoin influencer, so to speak, trying to make a positive impact. But it just was really never like the right fit for me. And after doing it for like two, I think it was about a year and a half or 2 years, I also started to realize that there needed to be someone out there fighting on behalf of Bitcoin from a political perspective. And I just didn't see anybody doing it. There were other groups that tried to start up and, they had great, they had a great shot. They were trying to get together and they tried to work with me and it didn't really work out. It wasn't a good fit. And ultimately I ended up going on and launching my own thing. And that's where Satoshi Action Fund came from, was through that realization that we need an organization out there, a grassroots organization, fighting for Bitcoiners and for Bitcoin miners to make sure that we can protect our rights, make sure that we can operate here in the US, and to ensure that people that want to stay here, that if you're a Bitcoiner, that you can. I mean, that's really, in a selfish way, part of the impetus for Satoshi Action is the fact that I knew my own rights were under threat. And then I knew that if I wanted to stay in America and hold on to my Bitcoin, that I was going to have to do something drastic, something big. And that big thing was launching Satoshi Action. And we've had a lot of fun along the way. We've, like you mentioned, passed law in two states. I imagine we'll pass more this year. I can't quite tell you how many it will be, but probably more than two this year. So it'll be a very exciting year for us to be able to continue to grow our momentum and build our relationships and have success for Bitcoin in America.
Yeah, awesome to learn, man. Like from what I've seen from you, I always thought you were you had a legal background, actually. But obviously, and this makes more sense, like it is more education, right? Like you have to understand what this is first before you can even draft a bill or understand what it could do for your state. So basically, you're going around the country and educating these people. How does this work? Like, how do you orange pill a state? Like, what are the strategies involved educating lawmakers and regulators?
That's another good question. Before I jump to that, though, I would like to recognize that, Satoshi Action is a group of people. We have our policy director, Eric Peterson. We have our science director now on the C3 side, Dr. Murray Rudd. We have our two co-founders, Mandy and Surya. And so like it's a collective effort. And one of the most important parts is having people like our policy director who are actually, has been doing this for a long time, understands how policy works. I'm like the Bitcoiner in the room, so to speak, the cheerleader, the face of the organization. But, there is people that are irreplaceable in the organization. So we're very fortunate that we put the team together when we did it. Sometimes these things are just timing. Like we just happen to all meet at the right time, right place, right time, right viewpoint of where things needed to go. But I would be remiss not to bring up all of the very important team members that we have. And then, you know, from an education perspective, when it comes to educating lawmakers, it really just starts with a phone call or it starts with an introduction. We reach out to people that we have seen that have a propensity to sponsor legislation like this. We find, you know, connections through various organizations. We might ask an organization that's on the ground in a certain state that likes Bitcoin, like, hey, have you worked with anyone that you know that is interested in this stuff? And we tend to, you know, year one, it was a little bit of work to find these people, but year two, it's gotten, I wouldn't say easier, but it's just, it's picked up steam. In fact, this year we've had state lawmakers reach out to us.
Wow.
Or groups reach out to us and be like, hey, we're already sort of getting your bill introduced over here. Quick example of that would be the Idaho Freedom Foundation. They're a right-leaning think tank in Idaho, and they, you know, sort of did all the hard work of getting it together. And so then we just came alongside them, and we've been fighting to get the law passed there in their state. But other groups have reached out, the lawmakers have reached out to the states, and some have just done it and not even talked to us at all. Like, there's awesome. there's one like that where it's just like they're completely out there on their own trying to get it done. So that is, you know, sort of the process of education starts with a phone call, starts with engaging, asking them if they want to learn about this policy. We get on a call with them. We start to walk them through why the policy matters and what it will do for their state. And then phase two is, you know, if they get it introduced and we get a committee hearing, which is the next big phase of the education process, we get the opportunity to go to these states and we try to talk to each of the lawmakers individually. And then at the committee hearing as well, we testify and educate on it. We bring one pagers, we bring educational resources. So those are a couple of the different things that we do. We also have done in the past during our off season, because this is right now, it's busy season. Busy season is like basically, you know, December to, I would say, May or June, roughly. Mm. But on the second half of the year, you have this period where there's not a lot of state sessions in play. They take a break. And so that's our off season. And that's when we'll do like real deep education. We'll do big long Zoom calls, or I'll travel to DC and do a briefing, or, you know, more in-depth, you know, Q&A type of situation. We don't really have the time for that during the busy season, but we do engage in that level of education on the off season. And then as a final point here, one of the most important things that we've done since launching is we also launched a research arm. That's the one that Dr. Murray Rudd leads. He is leading our ability to produce peer-reviewed research. We don't always get it peer-reviewed. Obviously, that's, you know, just like passing policy. You can't guarantee you're going to pass a law. You can't guarantee you're going to get something through peer review, but we try our best to put ourselves in the best position possible to produce at least an academic piece of work or paper, a piece of research, and then hopefully get it through the peer review process. We have helped others get through the peer review process. We've had some stuff of our own get through the peer review process. And that's really good because lawmakers love peer reviewed research. They love to hear from veterans. They love to peer reviewed research. They love to know how they're going to, you know, something is going to benefit their state. There's sort of these like items that are really important to cover when you're engaging with state lawmakers. And that research is a really valuable tool that we are just starting to really wind up and use in our advocacy efforts, because all the research gets turned and used to help us advocate better for the technology. So I'll pause there. There was a whole bunch all over the place. But yeah, ultimately, you know, education is really important to us as an organization, and we have done a really good job of educating lawmakers, and we've learned to do it in a very short fashion and ASAP, and we seem to have some success, at least more than I thought we would this early on in our organization.
Yeah. And so before you mentioned like the elements of self, like the rights to self-custody, et cetera, like what are key policy changes or introductions you think are essential, you know, for the proposals that you're creating? Do you have like an outline that you adjust to every state, or is it custom every time? Like,
We have what's called model policy. Model policy outlines the entire component of like what we're trying to get done with the legislation, and we take that model and we share it with other lawmakers. Or we share it with the lawmakers, and then they take it and they decide, you know, how much of it they're going to try to push forward. It's up to them, really, completely up to them on how much they want to try to introduce. And they will go to the state drafters, and the state drafters are essentially attorneys who will take that model idea and then they will draft it into state code. And so then at that point, once you have it drafted into state code, then you sort of go through the actual official like introduction process. So they take it to the drafter, then they actually go and they get a bill number, they get it introduced. And then from there, you work to get a committee hearing. But
when so they vote so, then, right?
Yes, the first time they'll vote, it'll be a small committee, and then it will go to the floor, and you know, then flip sides. Mm. But in that process, like there will be every state has its own sort of like code, so you have to match the law to the code. And most of the time, we don't have any problems with that. Every once in a while, they have to make small changes, and then sometimes lawmakers also want to have changes of their own. So there's a variety of reasons why a bill might be different in different states, but for the most part, the vast majority of the legislation is the same from state to state.
Yeah. So how do you foresee like the evolution of Bitcoin regulation in the US? Like we have some recent developments with the energy reporting, which was eventually canceled, I think. And now there's this 30% tax idea for the miners that you're also going against. Like do you have any insights, or what are your thoughts on how the federal government is approaching this?
Yeah. So as far as the EIA is concerned, you know, they sort of screwed themselves when they put in the emergency order. And so that's what ended up being seemed to be the impetus for why it got canceled. One of the benefits of them doing that was that they made, I believe, a lot of Bitcoin miners realize that we need to get ahead of this stuff, because we're lucky that they made a mistake and that it got canceled, because they'll come back and they'll want that information. And so what we should be doing is we should be getting out ahead of that and trying to provide more transparency. I said for a long time that the Bitcoin mining space would benefit from more vigorous transparency around the technology, and particularly in the realm of, you know, how much Bitcoin miners are participating in the grid. Hmm. So when the EIA put their survey out, they didn't know this, but we had also happened to be developing our own survey at Satoshi Action. And our survey didn't just ask for energy data. It also asked for the amount of curtailment that those Bitcoin miners participated in the month of January. And so for the month of January, we were able to collect a little over 1,500 megawatts of curtailment data. So that's, you know, 1.5 gigawatts of curtailment data for the month of January. And the numbers that are coming back are already pretty incredible. The amount of, you know, grid participation that's taking place from what is probably roughly a quarter or maybe a third of all Bitcoin mining in America, we were able to get data on all of that. And we want to make sure that that information really, really gets out there. And so the benefit of getting it out there is that lawmakers will be able to see more clearly the value of the technology. Because if you just say, how much energy is Bitcoin mining using, and you leave out the curtailment data, that doesn't paint a very clear picture. And it paints a tainted picture, right, of Bitcoin mining. Makes it look just like an energy hog.
Yeah, and curtailment is how they help balance the grid, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's the main point, right? To show how many are off grid, actually, right? And then how many are helping to balance the grids? Because when they asked for all the energy data, they don't mention these things. Maybe it's on purpose. Maybe they have no clue. But this is like the core of the arguments against it, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, people that are concerned about energy consumption are just going to see energy consumption alone, and they won't see the curtailment data, the grid balancing data that is taking place, which in the month of January, there were storms all across the United States, ice storms, winter storms, and there were miners curtailing all across the entire country. And that is really, really important, because that is a vital service. And it is inarguable that at this point, Bitcoin miners have probably saved lives, because when you look at Winter Storm Elliott versus Winter Storm Uri, Winter Storm Uri came 1 year prior to Winter Storm Elliott. Winter Storm Elliott was like in 2022, late 2022. And what it did was it showed that Bitcoin miners can and will participate in the grid in emergencies and at scale. And so in Texas, those miners there wound down, and in just that one winter storm, delivered 1,500 megawatts of power back to the grid, which is enough power to heat 1.5 million small homes. It's enough power to energize 300 large hospitals. It's an incredible amount of power. And it was happening right in the middle of when there was a winter storm where everyone else was clamoring to get energy. Power plants were tripping offline. People were turning on their heaters. It created an imbalance in the grid. Well, fortunately, you had Bitcoin miners and other things too. It wasn't just the Bitcoin miners, but that's a huge amount of energy that was delivered back during that emergency. But if you just go back one winter storm prior, Winter Storm Uri, almost exact same situation. Winter storm comes down, knocks out a bunch of infrastructure. People are turning the heat up on their homes as the infrastructure is coming offline. Except for that, the outcome of that was much worse, part in part, not completely. I don't want the energy experts in the world to, you know, shout me down, but Bitcoin mining was not there when that happened, right? Mm. So part of the reason why it was so much worse was because there was no energy asset, there was no load resource that was willing to deliver all of that energy back to the grid when it was needed. And yeah. In Winter Storm Uri, hundreds of people died. I mean, there was they almost went into a system-wide outage, or what people call black start, which is like the absolute worst case scenario. Like the grid actually almost went through complete collapse. It was minutes away. So it's a very bad situation, almost much worse than it ended up being. But fast forward one year, you go to Winter Storm Elliott, the miners had come into Texas. And this is probably an important point to bring up. The miners weren't there because they hadn't been banned in China yet. China bans the Bitcoin mining right after Winter Storm Uri. It all comes to Texas. And the next winter storm, the Bitcoin miners are there balancing the grid and, you know, saving lives and making sure the grid stays operational. So incredibly powerful technology. And we want lawmakers to really, truly understand the value of the capabilities of the technology. And if you're just looking at energy data alone, you don't see any of that. And that's why we push our survey out so hard. And we're working hard to make sure that we bring clarity to what this technology can do.
Yeah. And to simplify maybe a bit for the people who are listening, the main added value of Bitcoin miners who work with energy companies in a state is that the energy companies have resources that create energy, right? And they mainly want them to run at full capacity, but that's not always possible because not everyone wants the energy that's created at full capacity, right? So the miners help the energy companies run at full capacity because the miners will always take the electricity, use the electricity that the consumers don't want. But in a situation, as you mentioned, when there's, for example, a storm, everyone turns on their air conditioning, their heater, you know, whatever, the miners can scale down. Basically, the only industry that can scale down that quickly, as you mentioned before. And in that way, they can actually help the energy companies actually have all their resources turned on. Does that make sense? Is that a good simplification or would you add anything?
Yep. You got it. I think the biggest thing too there is just really that nailing in on that Bitcoin mining really is the only, you know, large load, you know, data center style infrastructure that can deliver energy back when, you know, everybody else needs energy. They are saying, here you go, you can take this energy. We don't need it.
Exactly.
Right now.
Yeah. And some people would say, well, you can also do that with AI data centers, but then you cannot render your crazy picture, right? Like, because then like all the servers will turn off basically. So it's the servers are essential to the to the entire business model of the services that they facilitate, right? But in Bitcoin mining, of course, that's true, but they get so much free energy that they are also incentivized to turn it off at the right time when they're asked.
Yeah, the other really important thing there that I think is most important to realize is the difference between Bitcoin mining and any other piece of energy infrastructure or load. Particularly, let's focus on data centers here since that's like the example. If you shut off large swaths, if you shut off region-wide Amazon data centers, AWS cloud servers, like you will experience very significant network interruptions, internet interruptions. Mm. And, who knows to what extent, but like you will for sure experience those interruptions. In the case of Bitcoin, it doesn't matter if you shut off all the miners in Texas, because there are Bitcoin miners across the entire planet and they're all doing the same thing. So like Amazon, like if you shut them down in a region, like people within that region are not going to be able to have a great internet experience, whether that be cat videos or Zoom calls or ordering
or
Uber.
Take money from an ATM maybe, who knows? Yeah, that's the point, right? You don't know what you shut off basically.
Absolutely. It could be something really vital to your life. But at bare minimum, it's definitely cat videos that are going first. I hope so.
Probably.
But with Bitcoin mining, because they're all doing the same thing at the exact same time all across the planet, it doesn't matter. You can shut them off here. You can shut them off in China. You can shut them off in Europe. Yeah. And there will always be some part of the world where they're not getting shut off. And the network is still operating. Now you might see like block for the nerds out there, you know, you might see some block times get expanded a little bit. But that problem is inevitably going to get solved once those operations come back online. Because these mines are getting shut off for hours or maybe a day. It's not like they're not getting shut off for weeks or for months.
Yeah, it's to facilitate the peak demand then of the energy, right? So how lots of people talk about like these things, right? Oh, it could be a different data center than, you know, mining a useless magic internet coin. That's what you sometimes hear. But there's also the other arguments that are like about environmental impact of Bitcoin mining. Like how do you address like these misconceptions that or like arguments that people use?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin is 100% fully electric, you know, operation. And so it's pulling energy from where everyone else is pulling energy from. So if you want to see, you know, if you care about the environment, if you care about the climate, if you care about, you know, decarbonizing our grid and moving to a fully electrified economy, like, then you should care about the energy that's being produced, not the people that are using it. And in fact, there's quite a few arguments now amongst certain I don't know what you call them, tribes within the environmental wing, which believe that we do need much more demand in order to be able to transition. I'm not an expert on that theory, but you know, I've certainly looked it up a few times, and I think there is some great points to be said about the need for more demand. I mean, there's plenty of people within the renewable space who'll say we need to 10x the amount of renewable energy that we create in order to get to a place where we're seeing real results on decarbonization. Mm-hmm. And so how do you get there? I mean, you're going to have to build wind and solar farms everywhere. And part of the problem with that effort is that you have to build transmission lines everywhere if you're going to do that. Because wind and solar have like two serious problems. One is they're intermittent, and the other is they have to be placed where there is good demand. Wind and solar, you know, availability, where there's, yeah, exactly. That also true, but.
And demand.
And demand. So it's a very tricky sort of thing. And so now what they've started doing is they're saying, well, we're just going to build these massive transmission lines all across the country. Well, you know, they're coming running into some issues with, you know, property rights here in America, where people are like, I don't want to sell my land and have this huge piece of high voltage transmission line infrastructure built across my property. And so it's making it very difficult. Well, I think long-term this problem gets solved, you know, for those that care about this issue. I think there are solutions on the horizon, batteries, and I think there is some headway on the transmission lines being built. But in the meantime, when those wind and solar plants are being built, when those farms are being built, and there's no one there to buy the energy because they can't get it to market, or the wind and the solar are creating energy when no one needs it, you have a Bitcoin miner coming in and monetizing all of that energy, which is critical for financing this. Like, this is the one thing that that a lot of my environmental friends are finally sort of fully sort of grokking and really understanding, is that you can't do, you still need the money. Like, you still need to afford it.
Yes.
It has to be feasibly economically possible. And Bitcoin mining, you know, and then they'll go back to my, you know, friends that are, you know, renewable haters, and they say, you know, renewables are a waste of, I mean, they're a dead end anyways, but so they'll hate my point that I'm about to make, but Bitcoin mining makes renewables way, way more likely possible and feasible. So that's one part of the argument. The other part is really that you have a energy asset which can monetize not just wind and solar, but it can also monetize stranded methane emissions from landfills, from oil and gas, from abandoned orphaned oil wells, you name it, from aquaculture. And that's critical. I mean, if you care about climate, if you care about the environment, you know, methane is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And it is a very serious problem where we see much more methane being produced and released into the atmosphere than we previously thought before. And there's not a whole lot of ways to economically tackle methane emissions, except up until when Bitcoin mining came about. Because yes, as we've mentioned of how Bitcoin mining can be placed next to a wind farm, solar farm in the middle of nowhere, it can also be placed on top of an oil and gas well, which is flaring or maybe even venting methane. It can be placed on a landfill, which is also potentially either flaring or venting methane as well. Capture that methane, put it through a generator, and that generator converts that methane into electricity. Because for those that are new to the methane game, methane is a combustible gas, and you can use it as a fuel source. And you can use it as a fuel source for a generator or a turbine, which creates electricity, and you can mine Bitcoin with that. And now you've essentially you're monetizing methane emissions. Instead of being like, oh, we got to spend money to tackle this problem, you're making money on the problem. So I'll pause there. Those are two big things I think on the environmental side that I think are really important, especially for your European audience.
Yeah, no, this is a really big thing I'm into, actually. Reducing methane, I think, is a top three UN development goal. Mm-hmm. And no one in mainstream media is talking about this, which I find fascinating, actually. It's all about carbon. But also, and as you mentioned, when you burn the methane, there's still some emission in the air, but it's like 90% less than if you just would just release it, basically, in the air. But what I love about Bitcoin is that you can actually make all these things economically viable. As you mentioned, I shared this with Daniel Batten to check what he thought. But as you said, like, you have to invest in a renewable energy source, right? So that is an investment, for one. And once you have it, you want it to be on the entire time, just so you make the most use of it, just using the thing, right? And then, of course, you want the energy that it produces also to be used 100%. And if the wind farm cannot be on all the time because the wind doesn't blow all the time, right? Then you especially want it to have like all the energy that it produces when the wind actually blows to also be used, right? And that is not always the case. So you can never get like 100% ROI. Is, of course, everyone wants that, right? But it's hard to obtain just because you have to, have the wind blow. But when you have a Bitcoin miner there, then at least when the wind blows, you can have 100% consumption of all the energy that it produces. So then you can actually get like 100% out of your investment. But then when you're making Bitcoin, you could actually get over 100% return on investment on, whatever it costs for you to create that wind farm. So yeah, I love how these, how money interjects with energy, and I think also when you talk about money, probably a lot of people will say, well, it's a technology to exchange energy between, entities to do trade, for example. So I think in these situations, like these illustrations, the power of Bitcoin really comes out. And do you see like a lot of people who are into like environmental stuff, like talk about Bitcoin? It makes so much sense for me, but I find it intriguing that you don't hear a lot about this, actually. Like, I think, why aren't climate activists all the way into Bitcoin, basically?
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, that's the $10 million question. And I think it comes down to the fact that there has been a significant effort to convince environmentalists and people who care about the climate that energy consumption is bad, and that it will result in poor outcomes for the environment. In my opinion, there is a pathway where energy becomes cheap enough where we are able to unlock new climate technologies. I mean, direct air capture, as an example, literally sucks carbon out of the air. It's a technology that pulls carbon out of the air, but it uses too much energy and it's too expensive to operate at scale. But if we have much cheaper energy, then we can begin to afford to do direct air capture. There is a growing movement in the environmental space. So I should be remiss not to say it's not all one-sided. There is a lot of people that think we need to focus on adaptability instead of simply trying to focus exclusively on how we can reduce methane emissions or carbon emissions. I'm not saying you should ever, environmentalists should abandon that, but there needs to be more focus on adaptability and getting ready for an environment, a changing environment where our climate is changing, where our environment is changing and evolving. And we need to start to come up with ways to survive in that environment and also thrive in that environment. And I believe that if we can reduce the cost of energy, we can have very positive impacts, not only for the environment, but also for society writ large, because there are other technologies that you can unlock, or at least make, profitable. When I say unlock, I mean like it doesn't magically appear. It just becomes more feasible. So that one is direct air capture. Another one is water desalinization. Water desalinization is extremely energy intensive, and there are millions, if not billions, of people without access to truly clean, sustainable water resources. And that's even getting worse as time goes on. It's getting much worse as the climate gets worse. You know, if we see actual climate change issues pop up to the extent that the direction that some people think we're going, there's going to be a water crisis all over the damn planet. And that's not going to be solvable once we're there. We're not going to go, oh, well, we should just reduce our carbon emissions, and then all of a sudden the water is going to come back to these places. It's probably not going to come back for large periods of time. There need to be other solutions. Other solutions involve sort of water desalinization, which is just too much energy. It's too intense right now. So how do we get there? We need to reduce the cost of energy. And in my opinion, the best way to do this is through nuclear, because you also achieve that carbon reduction component as well. And I think that Bitcoin mining will be a driver. I'm not the nuclear expert as it pertains to Bitcoin mining, but again, you know, this is a wide space with a lot of expertise, and I don't want to pontificate on something I'm not well versed on, but there are people in the nuclear space who see Bitcoin mining as an unlocking technology for that technology, which has been hindered by excess government regulations for decades now.
Yeah. Do you know anyone people can follow around that subject? Like
Nuclear Bitcoiner on Twitter. He's a good friend. Ryan McLeod, I think is how you say his last name. Apologies, Ryan, if I butchered your last name. I'm always calling him the Nuclear Bitcoiner. That's his Twitter handle. He's been on Peter McCormick's show, so he's got a good episode there. And then there are just other people in the nuclear space that have started to pop up, which are not really like Bitcoin folks, but just, you know, honestly, poke around. You'll find them. They're out there. There's nuclear is kind of an interesting group of people, the pro-nuclear folks, because they're very much like Bitcoiners, right? They're like, they're out here fighting for a better world. They're out here fighting for energy abundance. And oftentimes, you know, you find some of them are, you know, deeply concerned about the environment, particularly as it pertains to the climate and to carbon emissions. And they're like gung ho about nuclear, which is great to see, because, you know, we need a pro energy future that is also a pro environment future. And I feel like nuclear combines both of those things very effectively. Yeah. Now, of course, there's going to be those environmentalists who fully disagree with me and think that nuclear is untenable because of nuclear waste. But, you know, you can't win them all, I guess.
True. So what has been the most memorable or impactful experience you've had on this journey?
Oh, most impactful. I mean, for me, the time in the space that had the biggest impact on me was when I was holed up in my house, you know, during the closures on Clubhouse, and there was a lot of concern around people being able to operate, you know, successfully here as Bitcoiners in the United States. People had sort of developed this fear that, which at the time I had shared, that, you know, the government was going to come in and really be aggressive towards Bitcoiners, given the dynamic of Bitcoin being a very status quo disruptive type of technology. And so we were all huddled around talking about our plans to move to El Salvador, that sort of stuff, right? I hadn't, of course, made any real plans, but everyone was sort of theoretically talking about the need to go to another country. And I just sat there and thought about the fact that I have, you know, family members who I'd have to convince to join me in El Salvador. I'd have to sell my house. I'd have to sell the businesses. I've got my mother-in-law that lives beneath me. We'd have to, you know, figure out where she's going to go. And I just kind of realized, I was like, this is not looking very probable for me. And woke up one day and I realized, I was like, you know, I need to stop viewing this as a problem that can't be solved. And what instead I need to do is wake up with the intent that I want to make the United States the best place in the world to be a Bitcoiner or a Bitcoin miner, so that I'm never faced with the problem of being forced out of my own country. And that is really, you know, the changing point of where Satoshi Action came from. And it's the sort of the ethos that we live by, that like the states are where we're going to secure our rights, and that we are going to do everything possible to make sure that we drive that conversation forward. But yeah, I'd have to say that thinking about my future in that moment during the shutdowns and realizing that it wasn't going to be all rainbows and El Salvadorian beaches with surfing, I realized I need to get up and do what I need to do to make America the best place we can to be a Bitcoiner. And so I'll pause there. I thought that was that's probably the best, most impactful moment I've had so far in the space, but I'm sure there are many more to come.
Yeah, I love that, man. I mean, like, as you started your podcast, I'm also just starting a podcast. But eventually, I'm also thinking about, like, how can I contribute more to this, you know, because I feel like it would be an easy cop-out if you would, like, flee to El Salvador or just leave your country, whereas you can also contribute to that. So I love that answer, actually, because I'm also personally just exploring, like, what can I do within, you know, my region or my country. And so I think that's a great answer. And so with the Satoshi Action Fund, how do you measure the success of your efforts, and can you outline, like, your goals for the next years?
Yeah, definitely. And then just to highlight there on your, before we get into how I view success at Satoshi Action, but if anybody in any country, including yourself, Bram, wants to have a positive impact, you know, one of the best things you can do is probably find, go to a decentralized point on the power structure, right? Like, you're not going to, in the United States, you're not going to go to the president. Like, the president is not accessible. You're probably not going to convince the president to change just on your own. But then you go down to Congress. Same dynamic, pretty difficult to make an impact there. Some people are trying and they're having success, I think, in mostly defending Bitcoin, maybe not securing wins for Bitcoin, but securing good defense for Bitcoin. And then you go down another level, so you use state level, and then there's local, city, county. You know, we operate at the state level because that's where we know we can be successful at, but that might be too much still for one person as well. It might be better to go work with your local city, your local county, and just start educating them on the benefits of the technology. And then also always look for opportunities to, you know, branch out from there. That's what I always tell people, like, find the decentralized level of government that works for you. Maybe those decentralized government probably doesn't make too much sense there together, but find the path of least resistance. And that oftentimes means, like, starting just lower down the totem pole. That's always a great place to start to have a positive impact. Now going to success, we measure success through wins. We measure success through policy wins. We measure success through getting research done, particularly. We feel it's worth more if we get peer-reviewed research done. So that's our mile marker. I don't really see how we can measure it any other way. You know, there's a lot of, and this is just true anywhere you do the politics happens. It's really easy to say you did something, but it's really hard to prove you did something. But there's one way that you can prove you did something, that's by passing a damn law. And it's sort of irrefutable evidence that you provide proof of work. When we got started as an organization, we got started in the middle of the bear market and no one wanted to give us money. First of all, because they didn't have any money. Second of all, because we were new and we hadn't done anything yet. And so I turned to my team and I said, the only way we're going to make any money and the only way we're going to start fundraising is if we start producing results. Everyone completely agreed with that. And we got to work producing actual measurable results. That was started with policy. And now it's moved into research as well. But that is 100% how we measure success. Like, we certainly love to pat ourselves on the back when, you know, mild things happen and, you know, say, good job, go team. But to me, I don't feel like we don't deserve to raise money if we're not producing results. I'm not going to ask people to send money to Satoshi Action and, you know, in a year or 2 years from after the point at which they've donated to us, not have shown real measurable progress. I'll end there. It's pretty short and sweet, but proof of work is what we're all about.
And so if people want to help fund you, like, where can they go? Are you like, are you actively raising, or how does that work for a nonprofit like you're operating?
Yep. I mean, fundraisers are always happening. We are always raising money. Nonprofits are always raising money. We're not like a, you know, VC investment where it's like a capital raise. And then once they get done with Series A, they're done. So to some extent, we're always raising and deploying. And we feel like we've gotten pretty good at the raising and we're very good at the deploying. And so now we just need to get better at raising, get better at building more support. We've seen quite a big shift in support recently to the positive side. So we feel very confident about that. But yeah, if you're in America and you wanted to donate to us, you can donate to the C4. We generally tell people that are outside the United States to donate to the C3. Just like really creates like a lot of barrier between political activity and like foreign interaction. So, we try to do as much of that as possible. We try to get as many people into the C3 as possible that are outside the United States. And that really it's a win-win too, because the C3's outcomes are good for the whole planet. Whereas the C4 is definitely more US centric. And so if you care about the US moving the right direction on a policy perspective, or you just care about it, you know, Bitcoin doing well in any country, you know, the C4 is a great place to contribute to. And that's our Satoshi Action Fund. Sorry for the foreign audience. The C4, C3, these are tax designations from the IRS. So a lot of nonprofits will reference themselves by their tax designation because they're important. The C4 can engage in political activity. We can hire lobbyists. Oh, wow. We can try to pass bills. We can show up to testify, that sort of stuff. On the C3 side, which is more of a charity, that is focused on research. You can engage in some political activity, but generally you try to stay away from it. It's not your main mandate. You're really focused on education, really focused on research. At least for us, that's our mission. There are other types of nonprofits out there that do different type of work, but we have people donate to that outside the United States because it's not trying to effectuate policy or lobbying changes. Because that's sort of, there is some areas there where you got to be careful. So we just stay far away from it. And we just tell people, donate to the C3, support the research. The research is good for American lawmakers, but it's good for all lawmakers. It's good for all people across the planet, because you can take that research and you can share it with lawmakers in your part of the world. You can share it with lawmakers in America, and it's sort of has the same impact. Generally, you do want to see research come from your own region, but you can still get a positive impact from research done with from outside of it.
Awesome. Well, I will link to satoshiaction.io in the show notes so everyone can get their information there as well. Last question, and I ask everyone the same question, and that is, what is a core belief you will never let go?
Oh, man, Jesus. Snap me with a core belief. You know, I think that one of the things that I've really developed since getting into Bitcoin is that you need a money that doesn't allow for discrimination. You know, especially as we head towards this very divided time, you know, people have, you know, governments have began using money as a weapon against each other and against their, not only people they disagree with from a philosophical perspective, but from a political perspective as well. And I think that's a very dangerous weapon to put into the hands of a politician who wants to crush his political opponent. And it's one that it will be used, given just the dynamics of the political system that we live in right now. It's all out warfare in politics, especially here in the United States. And I don't think we survive well on the other side of, you know, Republicans or Democrats kicking the other one off of, you know, the dollar or the financial tool because of their political beliefs. You know, and that is possible today to be able to just politically discriminate. The financial rails that we've built are so powerful, and they are like a nuclear bomb in the financial world. We've already seen the U.S. be willing to use its power in a very aggressive way. In the past, it was to, you know, provide sanctions for, you know, terrorist organizations or terror funding countries. But then we've moved a little bit. We used it against Russia recently. We've used it against other countries as well, where they aren't necessarily funding terror, but they're doing stuff that we don't like, and we kick them out of the financial system. And it's just like, okay, how much longer do we go down this path until we end up in a place where Americans are getting kicked off the financial system because they don't agree with your political opinions? That's something that I think we need to be really, really careful of. And I think that Bitcoin solves for that. So that's why part of the reason why I am such a big supporter of the technology.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. Well, and thanks so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and maybe we can do it again in the future when you have more results to share. And yeah, as I mentioned, I will link to everything in the show notes so people can follow your journey and check out the Satoshi Action Fund. So thanks again.
Thank you, Bram. Thank you for having me on. And it was a great conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening.